Have you seen the new film, The Boys in the Boat? It tells the true story of the young Depression-era oarsmen from the University of Washington who inspired America when they faced off against Hitler's best at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, winning the gold medal in rowing. From the beginning, Washington's coach, played by Joel Edgerton, set high standards.
Eight-man crew is the most difficult team sport in the world. The average human body is just not meant for such things. Just not capable of such things. But average is not going to get a seat on my boat.
The film, The Boys in the Boat, is based on part of the 2013 book by Daniel James Brown, in which he tells the whole story of these young men who became the University of Washington's crew team and had a certain spark.
The boys who had made it this far were rugged and optimistic in a way that seemed emblematic of their Western roots. They were the genuine article, mostly the products of lumber towns, dairy farms, mining camps, fishing boats, and shipyards. They looked, they walked, and they talked as if they had spent most of their lives out of doors. Despite the hard times and their pinched circumstances, they smiled easily and openly. They extended calloused hands eagerly to strangers. They looked you in the eye, not as a challenge, but as an invitation.
Author Daniel James Brown reading from his book during our conversation in 2013. Many of you have found that at hereandnow.org. He started with the inspiration for his book.
The story literally walked into my living room one afternoon in the form of a woman named Judy Willman. She said that her father was under hospice care living at her home, and she had been reading one of my earlier books to him, and he wondered if he could meet me. So a few days later, I went down to her house and sat down with him. His name was Joe Rantz. And he talked a lot about growing up in the Depression. And then he began to talk about this experience he had had of joining the University of Washington's crew and ultimately of going to Berlin in 1936 and rowing against, among others, a German crew in front of Adolf Hitler and other top Nazis. And as I listened to that story, I was mesmerized by it.
Yeah. Well, we've heard a little bit about who they were. Set the scene, which is also a character, of where they were. Washington State, 1930s, late 20s, so unknown to Easterners that when they finally do begin rowing and come east, people think Seattle is in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, people on the East Coast, in some cases, literally didn't know where Seattle was. Seattle in the late 20s and early 30s was a pretty dark, dismal place.
And Joe Rantz becomes a metaphor for this time. His mother died when he was young. His stepmother didn't like him. She was an aspiring violinist and was living now in poverty with Joe's father, and they just left him.
Yes. In 1929, in the fall of 1929, Joe came home from school one day and found his whole family packed into a car with the car running, and his father told him that he was taking his new wife and the other kids and leaving, and Joe was not to come. And so for quite some time after that, he had to subsist by foraging in the woods for mushrooms and berries and poaching salmon from the Dungeness River.
Well, but that terrible rejection also may have been what fueled him. He gets to the University of Washington. He doesn't dress well, but he's a hard worker, and crew will keep him in school.
Yeah, exactly. Crew ultimately is his salvation. Because he had to depend on himself, he had nobody but himself to depend on. He became very independent. But he had a hard time trusting other people, understandably, after what had happened to him. And when he first joined the crew, he had trouble fitting in with the other boys in the boat. He had a hard time just opening himself up to other people or trusting other people.
You can't have that in a skull.
No. Crew is all about cooperation. Of all the sports that are out there, crew more than any other depends on a fine degree of mutual trust and mutual cooperation. The oars all have to enter the water at precisely the same moment. They have to be held at the same angle. The oars have to be pulled with the same amount of force. The crew really has to become one, melded together.
How big a deal was crew as a sport in the U.S. in the late 20s, 30s?
We forget. Crew was, in fact, enormously popular in the 20s and 30s. Hundreds of thousands of people would turn out for a regatta. Oarsmen were sometimes featured on the cover of Saturday Evening Post and other major magazines. And so becoming an oarsman was a big deal.
But what we see, though, through the prism of crew is, again, this East-West divide. The East Coast was said to own the sport of crew. You've had Princeton and Harvard. How much of an upset was it that the University of Washington began winning, beating these Ivy League schools with this ragtag team of what people, you know, people all assumed they were lumberjacks.
Right. It was a big deal. It was not a terrible surprise to the people from the West, I think, but it was a terrible surprise to the people from the East. These kids from the West coming in and suddenly beating schools that had had rowing programs for decades and decades. Nobody at the University of Washington had ever held an oar in his hand before he turned up at the crew house. Many of the kids rowing for the Eastern universities had rowed at least since high school age.
Well, and there was a little bit of dirty business because they win the Olympic trials, and suddenly the Rowing Association says to them, well, you know, you have to pay your way.
Right. What happened was a number of the sports writers from Seattle, within an hour of that, began making phone calls back to Seattle, and phones started ringing off the hook all over Seattle all that night.
Suddenly we're in Boys in the Boat, the musical on Broadway.
Exactly.
Because people are running around collecting pennies.
Exactly. By the next morning, there were people on the street corners collecting pennies and nickels and quarters. They sold little paper tags for a quarter apiece to raise funds to send the crew to Berlin. Within 2 days, they had amassed $5,000, which during the Depression was an extraordinary amount of money. And the boys from Washington were good to go.
We know who wins.
Right.
But yet, as you tell this story, we don't think they're going to win. How high were these stakes in this race?
The stakes were enormously high. I mean, they were representing the United States of America. And when you look back at it in the historical context, they were really representing a set of values that we still cherish today, opposed to a set of values that we, I think, universally despise. It's hard not to see it literally as a conflict between good and evil. The American crew, these guys were, I've come to know each of them, even though most of them had passed away by the time I started, by talking to their families. And these were 9 very nice young men, open-hearted, eager, pleasant. And they came up against the cynicism of the Nazi regime. That's part of what makes that gold medal race so compelling. It also just happened to be one heck of a race.
Unbelievable.
The Americans got off to a terrible start. They and the British were assigned the 2 outermost lanes, which meant they had to row into the face of a stiff headwind. The German and Italian boats, the 2 fascist states, were assigned the 2 innermost lanes, which were very much protected. So they started off with terrible handicaps. They missed the starting signal, so they
got off. Nobody could hear it.
No, they couldn't hear it. The wind carried it away. Plus, the starting signal was in French, and it's not entirely clear that any of them understood it. Their stroke oar, the fellow who sets the rhythm of the boat, the most critical oar in the boat, Don Hume, had been sick in bed for days leading up to the race, and they literally got him out of bed, put him in the boat, and asked him to row.
Yeah, but they had another weapon, the coxswain.
They had Bobby Mock.
Small but smart.
Yeah, and pugnacious. He was a real character. He was 5'7", which is how tall I am, so I identify a lot with Bobby Mock. And like any coxswain, he had the task of ordering around a lot of men who were much bigger than him. But he was very, very good at it. He commanded everybody's respect.
And in this race, he scared even the coaches, the University of Washington coaches. He held back so long.
He did. And he had a habit of doing this. He had a habit of terrifying the coaches. Washington liked to row from behind, but Bobby Mock would sometimes hold the boat as much as 4 lengths behind, an unreasonable distance from the leaders, and then wear down the other crews by just sitting in place and then turn it on at the end.
No.
And he kept getting away with it.
So Bobby Mock, with his megaphone on his mouth, is guiding these 8 rowers in front of him, holding them back. We're holding our breath. How can they possibly win? For a time, they can't even hear anything because of the Heil, because
right.
of the Nazis who
yes.
are cheering on the Germans.
As they come into the last couple hundred meters of the race, the Americans, the way they were positioned, rode right in under the stands where a good part of the 70,000 German fans were seated or were on their feet, cheering Deutschland, Deutschland, Deutschland. And so the roar of this chant overwhelmed them, and the other boys in the boat couldn't even hear Bobby Mock at that point. And so they're rowing in this sea of sound and just rowing on sheer guts at that point.
Yeah.
Right under Hitler's nose, they win by 6/10 of a second.
Quite something. But they kind of went back to, you know, they went to the University of Washington, so they became engineers. They
right.
became part of Boeing. They
yep.
they lived the lives that many of their parents couldn't have imagined
yes.
because of the poverty of the Depression.
Yes.
But never the accolades.
No, there was never, for one thing, they all arrived home in dribs and drabs, so there was never a grand parade or anything like that in Seattle. As they got home that summer, they did what they had always done. They immediately began looking for jobs in order to make it through another year of university at UW.
What did they tell you about what that was like when they were on the boat and everything was perfect?
You know, it was an experience that none of them ever forgot. And for the rest of their lives, until they were very old men, until the last two of them died, they were almost inseparable. Every year they rowed, every 10 years rather, they rowed an anniversary race on Lake Washington in front of news cameras. Their families became like one family. When there were only two of them left, Joe Rance and Roger Morris, they were both very old men at this point. Joe and Roger would get on the phone and sometimes sit for an hour or 2 hours and say almost nothing to each other. They just needed to be together, remembering that perfect thing that they had once been.
The Boys in the Boat, author Daniel James Brown, speaking with us in 2013. We have more at hereandnow.org.